Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a former Wisconsin teacher turned policy researcher about the increasing number of emergency teaching licenses that have been issued here in the state. Now, it's not science fiction or a cause for panic, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is warning that a fungus known as C. auris is spreading at an alarming rate. Short for Candida auris, C. auris has an estimated fatality rate between 30 and 53% for people who suffer an invasive infection. That's according to the World Health Organization. It's generally not considered a threat to healthy people. C. auris is difficult to diagnose. It's resistant to antifungal drugs, and the CDC is sounding the alarm because of the rapid rise and spread of cases in healthcare facilities across the U.S. where it was first detected in 2016. Dr. David Andes is a UW Health Infectious Disease Physician and Division Chief for Infectious Disease at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Andes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We have this warning from the CDC. Who should be most worried about this? Who in particular is taking action to try to stop the spread of this C. auris?
Primarily, healthcare institutions need to be aware of this, on the lookout for this in their patients. As you mentioned, not really something that the general public needs to worry about.
What do healthcare facilities do with a warning like this from the CDC? Obviously, I assume they're watching for a number of potential contaminants for vulnerable patients. What does this ask them to do now?
This asks them to be aware that this is an infection that is spreading. Be aware of how to diagnose the infection, and once identified in an institution, be prepared to prevent it from being transmitted to other patients, and be aware of how to treat it in the patients that they do identify.
I understand that this is a fungus that's resistant to a lot of our toolkit, or a lot of our antifungal toolkit. Can you talk about the difficulty in treating it and slowing its spread?
You're right. We really only have three medications that work against fungi in general. This particular fungus is typically resistant to at least two of these. So we really only have one medication that works, and the CDC unfortunately found that the rate of resistance to this remaining antifungal has tripled just over the last couple of years.
And that brings me to some research you've worked on over the years trying to find a new antifungal compound. How do we do that?
Right. As I mentioned, there are only three antifungals we have available to treat us. We're looking for new antifungals as natural products produced actually by bacteria that are colonizing insects.
Can you talk about some of what you and your team have found and worked on and the hopes that it could lead to development of something that we can use in clinical settings?
Sure. We found a large number of new antibiotics and antifungals that seem to have novel or new mechanisms of action. And fortunately, thus far, activity against many of these emerging resistant pathogens.
And what kind of testing do you have to go through when you locate a candidate, something that might help with fungi in the future? What does it take to get from there to the clinic?
Well, in short, it takes a lot. You have to undergo a lot of safety testing and efficacy testing in patients. So, many of the new compounds that we've identified, unfortunately, probably won't make it to patients for several years.
Now, with this CDC warning for people who work in healthcare settings, maybe nursing homes, where can they go for information about something like this C. auris fungus and what they should be doing in their clinics and other settings?
Probably the best source of information is, in fact, the CDC. CDC.gov has really clear information for clinicians and infection control practitioners on identification, treatment, and prevention of transmission, which is particularly critical for this fungus.
Dr. Andes, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Dr. David Andes, a UW Health Infectious Disease Physician and Division Chief for Infectious Disease at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at the CDC's warning about the rapid spread of the potentially fatal fungus known as C. auris. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison chef who's a semifinalist for a James Beard Award this year.
It's 1 hour before the restaurant opens, and the small kitchen inside Madison's Ahan is buzzing. Water is boiling, chicken is roasting, and dumplings are frying. Before they even begin taking orders for the lunch rush, the chefs are preparing two big catering orders.
So today it's three Lao egg rolls, three vegetable egg rolls, and three orders of wontons, a couple orders of dumplings, a couple orders of summer rolls.
That's Jamie Huang, co-owner and executive chef of Ahan.
Well, the word Ahan actually just means food, and I just like wanted it to be something cute and playful, and Lao was my first language, so I just thought it'd be like cute and be like, this is our restaurant food.
Ahan began as a food truck, but quick success made it clear that Huang and her partner needed something bigger. They took a leap and opened the brick-and-mortar restaurant in August 2020, the height of the pandemic. At a time when restaurants were folding left and right, Ahan blossomed.
Yeah, a lot of people, like, when they would pick up food, they were really happy, like, that there was something new that they could look forward to or something comforting, you know?
Huang calls Ahan's food comfort food, and at the heart of it is her mother, Manola Huang.
Earliest food memories? Probably her making papaya salad, like a mortar and pestle in the mornings, making sticky rice, like the smell of sticky rice early in the mornings.
And I make papaya too. She said, Mom, I like to eat papaya too. I
say, spicy food.
That's Manola Huang, who grew up in Laos.
And I say, baby, I make a little bit spicy for you. And she like to eat. And I make noodle soup for Mom, I need two hot chili and lamb. And I put lamb and hot chili for Jimmy. Some people young, they don't like to eat hot.
She got her start early.
Uh-huh. And bak chokong Jimmy there.
Oh yeah, I need one tofu
lump. Jamie Huang grew up in kitchens. Her family has owned restaurants across Wisconsin, in places like La Crosse, Beaver Dam, and Madison.
When I do the side job in the kitchen, peel the shrimp, she come to peel with me too.
My mom said I started becoming interested in peeling shrimp when I was like three.
Eventually, Jamie went to culinary school. That led to jobs at some of Madison's hottest restaurants, where she received high-end training. Still, she credits her mom, Manola, for being her biggest culinary inspiration.
I think it wasn't always the path I was going to take, but I've been really happy because, you know, I've been able to, like, take some of her recipes and I'll be able to pass them down. Like, her, like, cow soy recipes, like, from her specific city in Laos called Luang Prabang. It's, like, a specific soup to her. And she said her grandma taught her mom and her mom taught her, so... right now, I'm making a pram long song with chicken, a red curry udon with chicken, and then I'm also going to put a fried rice on it.
Jamie Huang's affection for her mother's recipes, her love of lime, chili, and cilantro, and her belief in using local seasonal produce is getting her recognized by her peers in the industry. She's a semifinalist for a James Beard Award as Emerging Chef. The nomination had an immediate impact on her business.
I mean, obviously it's been really crazy busy. Like, it was busy before, but now it's just like next level busy. I think for staff, you know, it's really showed them, you know, all their hard work is really paying off. And I think it's like setting the standard and setting them to teach new staff that comes in and showing them to always be proud of their work. And, you know, like anything's possible. Oh, you can take the rice from over here too. Everything that we've learned from my mom and everything is like, you know, really coming full circle, and like all the hours we put in and stuff, you know, it really just made it feel like super, super like rewarding, you know.
I'm happy for my daughter to do a good job, you know.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a new report that finds that the number of emergency teaching licenses issued in Wisconsin has tripled in the last decade. We'll talk to one of the authors of that report. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, the number of emergency teaching licenses issued by Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction has about tripled over the last decade. That's according to a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. There's been a big increase in the number and geographic distribution of schools where teachers are getting these temporary certifications. Don Kramer is a researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum and lead author of this report. He previously taught high school math for a decade in the Milwaukee area. Don, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. I'm really happy to be here today.
Before we get into the trends over time, can you tell us about these emergency teaching licenses? Why do schools use them in the first place?
Yeah, first off, we call them emergency licenses, and that's sort of a name that people call them, but that's not really what the Department of Public Instruction calls them. They're actually licenses with stipulations, and they're pretty common because sometimes districts get in situations where they just don't have coverage for something. Oftentimes, if a district can't find a candidate with a certification, they'll get an employee with a bachelor's degree, and they ask the DPI for an emergency license. Some scenarios where you end up using an emergency license is a teacher from another state moving to Wisconsin, so they have to get the specific requirements for Wisconsin, or perhaps a district is looking for one employee to work in another department, sort of an elementary teacher becoming a reading teacher or a chemistry teacher that's covering a section of biology for a year. So there's lots of different scenarios where you end up having a teacher with an emergency license.
Well, and I understand we have somebody who had one of these licenses on the line with me right now. You issued one of these licenses for your first year. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I worked for the farm, I was a high school math teacher, and even before that, I was an actuary. And when I switched from actuary to teaching, I got into a certification program for a year, and part of that program was I was teaching and also taking night classes while I got my regular certification. And it's a common situation where people are getting their emergency licenses so they can teach while they're learning.
Now, the new report shows, yes, these have been used all along, but what have we seen over time, over the last 10 years or so?
Yeah, our data has been, we looked at data from 2013 to 2022, and at the beginning of that that data, we had about 1,000 licenses being issued in Wisconsin. And in the last year of our data, 2022, we had 3,000 licenses being issued. So it grew by threefold. And when we looked at some of the details there, the largest areas of growth tended to be in three different situations: cross-categorical special education, regular education, and elementary middle school education. And those last categories are pretty general licenses for people that are teaching in a elementary school or a middle school. So it's cross-categorical special education, and then those two licenses for elementary and middle schools. Those are the biggest areas for growth.
And when I hear the beginning and end point, I might say, aha, well, that's got to be COVID-related, right? But when I look at the chart over that 10-year period, a lot of this jump happened before we heard of COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. There was no relationship here with COVID. We definitely looked into that because it seems like everything's being affected by COVID in the last couple of years, but this was definitely a decades-long trend.
Are there particular parts of the state or geographic regions that see a lot of this use of emergency teacher certifications?
Not really. When we look at different states, when we look at different schools, sometimes they get categorized as urban, town, suburban, and rural. And we were looking to see if there was a larger emergency license usage in some of those areas than others, and we're really not seeing it. If 40% of all licenses are in urban schools, about 40% of the emergency licenses, 40% of the growth was also happening in urban schools. So we didn't really see any place that was seeing a larger growth than anywhere else. They're all struggling to find teachers right now.
Talking to Don Kramer, researcher with the Wisconsin Policy Forum, lead author of a new report on the use of these These contingent teacher certifications, emergency teacher certifications, they're often called, tripling over the last 10 years or so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you facing staffing difficulties in your school district, whether you work there, send a kid there, are a kid there? Have you seen a rise in these teacher certifications? Have you used one yourself, like our guest? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don, people might say, okay, we've been using this all along, so why is it a big deal that we're using more of them now? In a way, it seems like, I don't know, we're using a Band-Aid for a tourniquet kind of problem, right? There's something bigger going on, and we're kind of filling in with these short-term solutions.
And that's something that we're definitely looking at, too, because these are normal licenses that get used regularly. They have a purpose, but with the large increase, we look to see, are they being used more often? If they're being renewed. And we were noticing that in the last couple of years that about 40% of the licenses in 1 year were going to individuals that in previous years also had licenses, emergency licenses, which made us wonder, are these being used longer term than just a quick fix, and if people are actually using it as a different alternative route for long-term training.
Is this related to, and we've talked on the show about teacher shortages in the past, is this related to bigger challenges when it comes to staffing in schools?
Probably, and I think districts, when they, you know, come across these shortages, then what happens is, you know, they quickly have to find someone, and so these emergency licenses are a good way to find a Band-Aid to a solution. If they can't find a candidate that's going through, you know, a normal school of education training program, then, you know, you can't wait a couple of years for someone to graduate. You end up using an emergency license because you need someone to be in that classroom in the upcoming school year.
And you write in the report about the use of 3-year licenses. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So there's a 3-year license that its specific purpose is if a teacher is already working in a school district and they're licensed for a different subject area, but they want to expand into a new subject area. DPI has it set up so that you can get this 3-year license because they anticipate that it'll take you 3 years to, or at least at most 3 years to get, you know, licensed in another subject area. So, like I was saying before, an elementary school teacher that wants to be a reading teacher, or, you know, someone that's teaching one section of science wanting to do a different high school section of science so that they can take night classes and get that certification for that other subject area.
Let's bring on a caller. Mark is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mark?
Good. Well, I think, you know, when you started looking at when this whole trend started with emergency licenses going up in numbers every single year, and you failed to link that to the consequences of Act 10, I think you're really not being very smart about the whole thing. I mean, you take a look at Act 10, the average teacher lost somewhere in the vicinity of $7,000 of disposable income because they had to immediately start paying for their own healthcare and retirement benefits. And that caused them out of pocket about $7,000. Couple that with the fact that, you know, they may still have unions, but they have to recertify every year. Act 10 created an environment where teachers, you know, the people that were thinking about going into education or thinking about early retirement, jumped on the boat and got out.
I gotcha, Mark. Thanks for the call. Don, the timeline kind of matches up. Do you see any kind of correlation with the passage of Act 10 on public employee unions and this increasing demand for these emergency certified teachers?
We didn't actually see that directly, and it's also hard to tell, you know, if there's lingering results from Act 10. So we didn't see anything like right away in direct relation to it, but I could definitely understand someone thinking that there's long-term issues. I mean, Act 10 also just plays into the role of, you know, people leaving the profession, people not entering the profession, and that pipeline issue is the emergency licenses are part of that pipeline issue.
Thanks a lot for that call. Don, you've done this report. What are you hoping that, you know, school district leaders and others do with this information you've gathered?
I'm hoping that they start realizing, you know, that this for one thing, that it's a growing situation for everyone. It's not just something localized in their individual districts. And hopefully they start thinking about, well, if people are using this as an alternative way of training teachers, how do we make sure that our incoming teachers are getting fully trained and are getting all the experiences that they really need so that they can be the best teacher workforce that we have in the state?
And are there things you're hoping to see either from the state legislature or the Department of Public Instruction or maybe education schools here in Wisconsin to reflect this changing reality?
I haven't really thought about that. I'm hoping that policymakers just use this information so that they can make wise decisions in the future.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much. This has been great.
That's Don Kramer, researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum, former teacher himself, as we heard. We talked to him today about his new report on the increasing use of emergency teaching licenses in Wisconsin over the last decade or so. If you've experienced this yourself, if you've used one of these licenses as a teacher, if you work in a school district that's had to rely on these, love to hear your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. Again, that's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Jane Goodall devoted her career to studying chimpanzees and to protecting animal species and their habitats. She joins the show to make the case for hope and action. Also, voting violations are rare in Wisconsin. When they do happen, it usually involves formerly incarcerated people, possibly confused about their voting status. We'll find out who can vote and when. And we're going to talk about creativity, your creativity. What do you do to be creative? Is there something you've made or created that you're proud of? Let us know now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then people often receive aggressive, even invasive medical care toward the end of life, even if they and their families didn't want it. We'll dig into a new investigation on end-of-life care and the tough decisions along the way. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the UN released a new climate change report that warns of serious catastrophes looming in the next 10 years unless major changes happen. We'll ask our guests why these types of reports haven't been able to stir more direct action to tackle environmental issues. First, end-of-life decision-making can be difficult and emotionally challenging, whether we're making our own decisions or making them for or along with a loved one. One big question, how aggressive should medical care be in the last days or weeks of life? Our next guest has followed that issue, including a new study that finds that aggressive medical care is fairly common for people in the latest stages of terminal cancer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had this experience recently in your own family, something you'd be comfortable sharing about? Did the person get the care they wanted and not get the care that they didn't want? What questions do you have about end-of-life care and these difficult conversations with family members and healthcare providers? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Paula Spann is a journalist who writes columns for the New York Times called The New Old Age and Generation Grandparent. She's the author of the book When the Time Comes, Families with Aging Parents Share Their Struggles and Solutions, and she teaches in the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Her recent piece for the Times is called Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. Paula, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be with you, Rob.
You've been talking about these issues for a long time. I want to start with your piece on this more recent study focusing on cancer patients and the treatment they get. What were researchers looking at and what did they find?
Well, just as background, people have been working for years to try to reduce aggressive care at the end of life. It's not what patients say they want. They don't want to die in hospitals. They don't want to be kept alive by machines. In general, they want a peaceful passage. And so for the Medicare approved coverage of hospice care 40 years ago, 1983. So I was interested to see that in this new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, these researchers at Case Western Reserve School of Medicine found that the amount of aggressive care was still so high. These were patients who were in the last 30 days of their lives, and they had metastatic cancer. That means cancer that has spread. So these were people who were not going to recover. And yet, 58% of them who were just older people living in the community, these were all Medicare beneficiaries, 58% of them got aggressive care in the end of life. And if they were nursing home residents, it was 64%. And aggressive care in this case means things like, were they being treated for their cancer? Were they getting surgery or radiation or chemotherapy? Were they being sent to the emergency room? Were they being sent to the ICU? Were they enrolled in hospice in time for hospice to really support them? So it's discouraging that after all these years, this is still the case for this population, which was so clearly at the brink of death.
And to put some names and faces on this, you start your piece looking at an example. You talked to someone named Jennifer O'Brien about a story from her family and her father. Can you tell us what she shared with you?
Sure. So her father, Jennifer O'Brien, lives in Little Rock, Arkansas. Her father, who was 84, was a very independent guy, lived alone in rural New Mexico, said he didn't need any help. But a neighbor found him on the floor with a broken hip and called an ambulance. So Mr. O'Brien was already in very poor health. He had heart failure. He was a smoker, so he had advanced lung disease. He needed a walker for a spinal injury. He was so short of breath that he had to use a thing called a BiPAP, which is a kind of a portable ventilator with a tight mask over your face. And he had to wear it all the time, except when he was eating. So when he was in the hospital and Jennifer became involved in his care, they were just, the surgeons wanted to repair his hip. And that's a big repair. That's a big operation to repair a hip. And this was a person who was very close to dying, but he was mentally competent to make his own decisions. So when his daughter said to him on the phone with a palliative care nurse practitioner, "Dad, your heart and your lungs are just done," he decided no, he did not want to undergo this surgery. The anesthesia is dangerous to older people. The inability to move around is dangerous to old people. Hospitals themselves are often dangerous to old people. He decided against having the repair. The doctors were upset, called Jennifer thinking, well, you can talk him into it. She said she declined to do that. And she called a hospice and he died in a few days. And she went to see him and she was with him at the end, but he declined to undergo aggressive care. But he was able to make his own decisions. Oftentimes it's families that are making these decisions for people, and that can be where a lot of the problem arises.
Talking to Paula Spann with the New York Times, she wrote a recent piece on aggressive end-of-life care. Sometimes if it's not what the patient wants, what their family wants, or if it's the best call for a patient, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Pretty much every family is going to go through a moment like this at some point. Maybe you have an experience to share with us from your own family. If you're looking at this from the healthcare provider perspective, love to hear what you've seen as well. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Serena is with us in Menominee. Serena, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to share with us, Serena?
So I went through, I guess you would say, a hospice care with my aunt. So previously, she had gone through so many doctors. She had so much wrong with her. She had lupus, osteoporosis, osteoarthritis, rheumatoid arthritis. You pretty much name it, she had it. And so what had happened is one toe had been slammed against, this is where it all started, sorry. And one toe had been slammed up against something and it ended up dying. So they had to remove the toe. and then that caused an infection in her leg. She had to have one leg removed. And then the other toe, the big toe on the other leg, died. It just, there was no rhyme or reason for it. It just happened. And then they found out that her neuropathy had gotten so bad that there was no, like, massive blood flow to her leg. So she had to have the other leg removed. And after that, like, it went downhill pretty quickly. And she had decided on her own to go into hospice care. And I asked her probably about a week after she had signed the papers that I'm like, why are you doing this? What is wrong? You know, what can I help with? She's like, I'm just sick of being in pain. And to me, that was an acceptable answer because she's my aunt. I've known her all my life. You know, I took care of her for the last 5 years, taking her to and from every single doctor's appointment from here to Timbuktu. And to me, that was an acceptable answer. And she died a month to the day after signing the hospice paper.
Serena, thanks for sharing your story. Paula, every story is unique, but I think a lot of common themes in there, how people make these difficult decisions. Can you talk a little bit about what we heard from Serena there?
Yeah, Serena, I'm sorry for your loss. Mm-hmm. And you were spent 5 years as a family caregiver. That's a stressful role. But I agree with you that it's a perfectly acceptable answer if a person of any age, but especially an older person who may never recover to be the person they used to be after multiple medical interventions. I think it's acceptable for that person to say, I've had enough, I'm sick of pain, I want a comfortable ending, but I don't want to prolong my life. But I will point out that when we talk about why is there so much aggressive care at the end of life, there's plenty of blame to go around. So you will hear family members often say, these doctors just won't have a frank conversation. We don't even know that someone's dying. They don't know exactly how to say it. They keep suggesting more and more procedures and operations and drugs, and there's always something else to try. And on the other hand, you will hear healthcare professionals say, no, it's the families. The families don't want to let go. The families are saying, do everything possible. We can't let them die. And I think what we all have to remember, regardless of what our role is in this process, is that immortality is not one of our options. We all have to face death, and we should have choices about how to do that. But the idea that we just, that the system has to keep you alive at all costs, puts you on this kind of medical conveyor belt that your aunt was on, where there's you do this and then you do that and then this problem arises, so then you have to fix that. And I think people have the right to say, I've had enough now, let's stop.
Serena, thanks again for being willing to share that with us. We'll go to Jim now in Menominee Falls. Jim, hi.
Hi. I wanted to share the end of life of my father, which was about a decade ago. He was a family physician and, you know, took care of many patients from birth to death. He really did everything. And when it came time, he was suffering from prostate cancer and a hip replacement and renal failure. And so he knew he was towards the end of life, and he had a shunt put in for dialysis. And I was with him when he went in for the procedure, and he made it very clear to them that this is a DNR, you know, situation. He did not want to be resuscitated. And when they put it in, there was a problem and his heart stopped, and they brought him back, put him on a ventilator, and they had him on a feeding tube, and they couldn't, you know, because they told me that it was because it was during a surgical procedure, they couldn't, you know, they couldn't do the DNR and we didn't really get a clear answer to that. And so there were long decisions about, you know, how do we do this? Do we, you know, we were the ones that had to, you know, take away the feeding tube, take away the breathing tube. And there was, you know, several days there where, you know, you could tell that the patient was in agony, even though he was in a coma. And it was, you know, it's a horrible situation for anybody, but for a physician who knew everyone, and they still did those things, even though he expressed DNR, you know, that was very troubling.
Jim, I'm sorry you went through that, and thanks for sharing that. Paula, an express decision made, no, there's a do not resuscitate order, but in the heat of surgery, that order is ignored. Is that common?
Oftentimes, if there's a surgical procedure, they do say, You have to revoke your DNR while you're in surgery, and then you can restore it afterwards. It is troubling, Jim, you're right, especially for someone who had foreseen this possibility and thought he had taken a precaution against it. But I would just mention to people who are in the crunch with family members who are near death, but there are all these procedures and operations being proposed, that the magic words in a hospital are, there's two, three. One is palliative care. Palliative care doctors are the ones that help people be comfortable and manage symptoms, but they are not necessarily dealing with curable diseases. And the other is hospice, which is the Medicare-funded program for people at the end of life. And it allows most people in hospice to die at home, which is where they want to be and not in a hospital. When you say palliative care, I want a palliative care consultation, or when you say we want to call hospice, that's kind of a signal to the staff at a medical institution that you understand that death is near and that you're trying to keep this person comfortable, you're trying to give this person a good death, the so-called good death, but you're not expecting miracles, and that you know that immortality is not on the table. So I would just pass this along to listeners to know palliative care and hospice. But Jim, it's infuriating, and I'm just so sorry he had to suffer.
Jim, thanks again for sharing that. We are talking about end-of-life care, why it's sometimes more aggressive than patients and their families want. Journalist and author Paula Spann is with us from the New York Times, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this ringing a bell? Is this something you've been through in your own life, maybe recently with a loved one? If you are a healthcare provider, what do you want patients to know? Do you work in hospice or palliative care? Love to hear your perspective as well. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Paula Spann, journalist and columnist of the New York Times. We're talking about a recent piece she wrote called Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. Before we go back to our callers at 800-642-1234, Paula, you write in your piece that there's one kind of weird thing in the system where Medicare, people receiving Medicare who are in hospice care, sometimes have trouble getting treatment that they can actually use that would be palliative care because of Medicare guidelines. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, it's a little complicated, but basically when you enter hospice care, you give up curative care. So you can still get all kinds of treatments if they help keep you comfortable, but you can't get things like curative surgery for cancer. And so this tends to make certain groups of people reluctant to enroll in hospice in time. And hospice, let me explain, really people should be in hospice care for weeks and months, but the length of stay is very short. People wait till the very last minute, but hospice can do great things for families, give great support, and people shouldn't wait until someone's a week from dying. In this case, there's something called concurrent care, and where you see this is with people who are in kidney failure and they're on dialysis. So if you stop dialysis and you're in kidney failure, you will die in a week to 2 weeks. But the Veterans Affairs healthcare system is more liberal in its criteria than regular hospice. And so through the VA, the people in kidney failure can continue to get what's called palliative dialysis. It controls your symptoms, it helps you feel better, but you don't have to go three times a week for 4 hours. You can do it less often, you can do it for less time. And so those people, I talked about a study done in the VA. When you require people to give up dialysis in order to enter regular Medicare hospice, they die within a week or two, but when you allow them to have concurrent care through the VA, they live for another, let's say 40 days, I think it was 43. So that gives people time to see family, to see friends, to say goodbye, to, you know, maybe enjoy one more spring or go to a granddaughter's wedding. But more to the point, if people have to give up things that they have come to rely on that make them feel better in order to enter hospice care, Sometimes they just don't. So there, Medicare is pilot testing this in several locations, and we may see change on that in the next year or two.
Let's go back to our callers. Rana is with us in Rice Lake. Rana, what did you want to share with us?
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you to your guest. I've cared for both my parents towards their end, and they both had incredibly different end-of-life experiences. My dad moved in with us. We live in an area that has relatively stable health care. We're still rural, but we have people on staff and in a good, stable work environment. So when my dad needed hospice, it was available. We had people coming. His end of life was calm and smooth and was what I would have wanted for him. My mom, however, had lived in a much more rural community, had one hospice staff member who was not even from that area, who came from St. Croix Falls to do the hospice work there. That's about a 4.5-hour trip. Hospice and palliative care were so, there was so, the staffing was so short, the communication was so terrible. Some of the staffing came up from Mississippi to work in this care facility because there wasn't enough. My mom was the one in the nursing home yelling, help, help, for 4 months while she died a horrible death. Her sister, who is the POA, couldn't come to terms with mom needing to go on hospice, so she would just allowed mom to suffer terribly, and it was one of the worst experiences I've ever had in my life. I was with my parents both until the end, of course. That's where I needed to be, but I will be forever questioning that particular care facility's abilities to really care for people in their end of life.
Well, Rana, I'm so sorry about that experience, but it raises a big question, Paula. Even if we do agree that we want more people to have more hospice access, do we have the staffing? Do we have the facilities to accommodate that?
Well, hospice has really grown so that the most recent statistics are that now about half of the Medicare recipients who die in most recent year died in hospice care. So it's huge growth. And most places do have at least one, but you want a choice, really, of hospices. But what Rana talks about is a problem with all kinds of healthcare, which is rural areas have trouble getting and keeping personnel. And the distances are so long that it can become economically infeasible. So it is a big problem, not related only to hospice and palliative care, but all kinds of care. I've just recently written about people unrelated to this topic, people who put off having necessary procedures like colonoscopies or cataract surgery because they don't have anyone to pick them up and take them home. And that, you know, when people, 1,000 people wrote in with comments, and one of the refrains was, think about what happens if you're the nearest healthcare, the nearest ambulatory surgical center is a 2-hour drive. It's just, it's a big problem that goes beyond end of life. But Rana, it's a very sad story. I will say that in my own family, we have managed, both my parents and my sister, I have accompanied to their deaths. And this is in New Jersey in each case, and where there's plenty of hospices and plenty of healthcare providers. But you do sometimes have to be the one who stands up and says, you know, I am her surrogate decision maker, and I say, we've had enough. I know what her wishes are. She would not want to live like this. No, we will not consent to this proposed treatment. No, we are calling hospice. And I'm just sorry, Rana, that you were not the person who had that legal authority for your mother, because it sounds like you knew what to do and it couldn't happen. It's a terrible situation.
Rana, thanks again for calling. And Paula, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Paula Spann. She writes the New Old Age and Generation Grandparent columns for the New York Times. We talked with her about a recent piece she wrote headlined, Aggressive Medical Care Remains Common at Life's End. Coming up after the news, a political scientist and a sociologist from Wisconsin join us for a look at obstacles to taking more significant action to fight climate change, even as the UN put out another dire warning about imminent consequences. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.